Welcome to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. This is show number 53, The Renaissance Inside, a conversation with Alan Samerjian. Poet, essayist, songwriter, and high school English teacher. He has a full-length book of poems in The Architecture of Bone, published by Gen Pop Books. A chapbook of poems, an improvised device, Lock and Load Press, and his work has been anthologized and published in several different literary magazines and journals. His newest music release is Quiet Songs for Loud Times, New Song Recordings. The producer. He was named a New York State English Council Educator of Excellence. He writes regularly for Long Island Pulse, lipulse.com, and you can check out his work on alansemerjian.com, S-E-M-E-R-D-J-I-A-N. Also, he has work at alanarts.com and numerous variety of pieces in various all-book books, anthologies, and haiku calendar. This is the beginning of the second year of Between the Lines. This is your host, Monk. Thanks for listening.
But they can't give musician's store. The guitars on the wall have seen the best of years. They fought for what was right, sometimes whatever was wrong. Now the cases are closed.
Welcome, Alan Samerjian. It is nice to have you on Between the Lines. How are you doing today?
Wonderful. Thank you for having me.
Good. You're welcome.
It's a pleasure to talk to you, Monk. Thank you.
You bet. You're a English teacher at high school, right? Because you're on the summer vacation time.
Yeah, that's right. Although it feels like I'm never really on vacation because of some of the other things I do, but yeah, with regard to time in the high school, I'm officially cast adrift right now.
All right, and being you're sort of, I think of you as like a sort of Renaissance artist kind of guy because you do so many different things. So, you seem like a person who summer you'd be quite busy with your music and writing and all that.
Yeah. It's just a space, you know, they're all spaces, you know, for learning and the classroom is, then the year kind of goes, and then the time in the summer is, you know, another space. So I'm writing a bunch for a new book of poems, a new chapbook that's kind of in the works, with some Long Island people. And then, obviously the music, I just released a new record. So I've been, you know, kind of promoting that and partnering with a label for the first time in my life. So I'm in conversation with them a lot and some radio promotion and a little bit of touring as well, a few performances here and there. So it's an exciting summer.
Wow, that's neat. Yeah, that's we're going to get to the music part a little bit later on because I listened to the new album and it's I got a lot of, like it a lot. So
great, thank you.
Yeah, I wanted to start off with just mentioning some of the, like, I realize you're sort of eclectic participation in all books, and you've got a short essay in the Modern Muses anthology, and then a poem in the Walt Whitman Primal Sanities anthology, because you actually were a caretaker at the Walt Whitman birthplace for like a year or two, was it?
Yeah, about 3 years and some change.
And then I was looking at your essay in the Modern Muses anthology, and it's called The Toast. And you're talking about, I guess, I mean, some kind of wedding or something where there was this official toast, but it's a really neat essay because you kind of take that, the energy of what a toast is, and apply it to life in general.
like you're writing, you got, maybe for me, inspiration comes from a celebration of what is strange in this world, or at least estranged.
Mm.
And then, you know, you're saying, like, I write poems from this place, and the poems are part of a history of conversations about whatever it is we are conversing about. So it's, I like it. You kind of blend the sort of everyday life experience into the art. And then you mentioned the teaching, too. I teach from this place, too, because we cannot truly learn if we are not inspired. And the classroom may be the most important space of all to leave room for toasts.
Yeah, to celebrate others, really, to celebrate risks and risk-taking and kind of what we've learned. Yeah, the classroom is sort of that space. Yeah, I'm looking at the essay now myself. And it was a real toast that kind of started this thing. Yeah, I think it's really important to celebrate, you know, that kind of thing, learning, and also just recognizing, acknowledging other people's, in the case of this essay, idiosyncrasies. You know, I mean, the person giving the toast was kind of going on tangents and things like that. So it wasn't the most succinct thing in the world, but I just thought it was a wonderful, eccentric detail to celebrate. You know, even that needs to be sort of celebrated as well.
Yeah, it's like I think you had some poem, because you write, have some essays and articles in the Long Island Pulse magazine. There was something, maybe a poem about something about the butt sewing. Poetry is like sewing the buttons on a dress or something like that. Do you remember that one?
Sewing
something up. It was like when you find a poem. I forget what I got from it. Was like, you know, how writers are noticing those little quirky things that go on in life.
It's
like, instead of some meaningless moment where a button falls off a jacket, it's like that has meaning and art. There's art in there somewhere.
I mean, that's what it's our job. I mean, you know, Yevgeny Yevtushenko said we're the journalists of the world, you know, the Russian poet. And, you know, I think we are. I mean, I think journalists, I don't know, have some sort of connotation now that we have to, you know, bring. I don't know, sometimes it has negative connotations.
Sure.
And they have, particularly if the, you know, integrity is lost in the process of getting the story or something like that. But the idea is that we're bringing to attention these things to others, you know, and I think, I mean, that's really what all artists do, right? I mean, the writers do it, but then, you know, I'm thinking about painters and my grandfather and, Simon Samsonian, the Cubist painter, and just, you know, seers, you know, musicians as well.
Right.
It's kind of, I mean, I guess that's the role of art, is to kind of bring things into attention for, we can sort of have conversations about them, or continue conversations for, you know, because some of these conversations have been going on for like thousands of years.
Oh yeah, I noticed that, like with some of the haiku. Like sometimes I'll write a haiku, and then it's very similar to something that was written hundreds of years ago, and I realize, wow, that's pretty neat, because certain experiences just don't go away. You know, like I could be out there looking at the moon and have the same kind of insight or experience that some Japanese dude had, like, you know, 400 years ago, and there's something about that that's pretty neat.
Yeah, my friend Scott and I used to talk about that a lot when, you know, particularly on Long Island soil, sometimes we feel transported by looking up at the sky, you know, and you sort of, when you lose sight of your terrestrial grounding, your horizon, you kind of look up and all of a sudden time shifts too, like you can go back 100 years, 2,000, you know, 500 years or whatever it is. Because, you know, the sky is the sky, I mean, I suppose. Well, maybe the environment. Well, maybe the sky is not always the sky, depending on what city you're in. Because you can't always see it purely anyway. But, you know, but it, for the most part, in theory, you should be, you know, it transports us. I love that idea.
Another little paragraph in that essay I like, because it clicks in with that sort of renaissance multi-artist thing, because there's numerous art forms mentioned. You have, I write songs from this place. I try to sing with honesty and integrity and with equal attention to the notes that are sung as well as the notes that aren't. That fits perfectly with Between the Lines, because that's what I, you know, like to highlight. Like, there's this written stuff, but then sometimes there's, you know, it's just as important what's not written. And then you have a guitar strum is a gesture in the room with walls, a composition, the walls itself. If I can dance, you can dance. If you can dance, dot, dot, dot. Mm. So you got, I like the way you merge the whole poetic kind of riff in there. You know, you start off with a very personal statement about, you know, sing with honesty, but then you riff on it. So, you know, I think that's how I see some of what you do is like it represents that people that are multi-leveled with their arts and how each one helps the other. You know, some people are more focused, they just write or they just write poems, but then some people write, they do music, they do a lot of stuff, and it's interesting how each one affects the other.
Thanks for noticing. Yeah, you're right. I mean, they do affect each other. Thanks for noticing that.
Yeah, do you notice, is it just like an instinctive thing, or do you notice like changing hats when, you know, now I'm writing a song, now I'm writing an essay, or do you just kind of just get into it?
I think, you know, when I stand back, I notice it. Mm-hmm. When I'm kind of in it, you know, I think the inspiration, you know, the thing that's lit inside that, you know, that is prompting the essay or the poem or the song or whatever, you know, maybe, you know, that thing inside is too busy, you know, lighting a fire to really notice, you know, what's going on otherwise. And I think when I stand back, you know, particularly when I'm revising, I think when I'm generating things, it's just kind of in the moment of, you know, I kind of block other things out, and then that's it. I'm just generating whatever it is, the thing that I'm creating. I think it's like that for a lot of artists, actually. They kind of lose sight of other things. And then, but in the revision stage is when I really think about sort of genre and discipline and form and medium and that kind of stuff. I start thinking of audience a little bit and you know, what am I doing? How is this song, how is this poem, how is this essay different than other pieces of journalism or whatever? You know, that's when I kind of get into the, you know, the fine tuning stuff, you know.
The
revision and the editing, yeah.
Yeah, it's sort of like a left brain, right brain thing where the creative act is just sort of this ecstatic, you know, into the state of the creation itself, and then step back and like, you know, after, it's like having a, you know, some wine, and then the revision is like, all right, time to break out the coffee cup and go over it.
Didn't Hemingway say something about like he would write all morning and drink all afternoon or something like that? Something like that. These two other, I mean, you know, who knows if revising when he's drinking kind of relates to what we're saying, but the idea is I could never actually, I needed, you know, if I'm going to have some sort of, you know, intoxication, and I don't necessarily mean that literally, I'm kind of like just really being sort of fired and kind of, you know, high on life or whatever, I'm in it, you know, then the other, whether, if I'm doing that and I'm drafting or generating text, then my revision stage for that work has to be sober, you know, literally or figuratively, and then vice versa, you know what I mean? So if, like, if I'm writing in this, drafting in a kind of sober state, then I sometimes think it's important in this revise or editing moment to kind of see it from a different angle, you know, to be kind of inspired, to be moved, to be imbibing or whatever with the the mall of life.
It's an ongoing dynamic for the artist to sort of like a whole holistic artist where you're doing all the different roles and you have to, you know, change the hats and figure out which one to be. Another one, I don't know if you still do a lot of artwork, but there was one, you have this sort of, I don't know, you could look at it a lot of different ways. It's like the moon or the sun with some mountains and some scraggly trees. A piece of artwork you did that and wound up on the cover of one of my books of poems and essays, Impeach the Monsters, New Dawn. And it's sort of like a, I don't know, some people looked at it and said it was sort of like this sort of depressing, bare thing, and I was like, yeah, well, that's what it fits perfectly with the you know, the book and the title, and you know, you had given me that piece of art and used it on the cover, and I love it. And what was neat too, I mentioned that before, there's actually did one of the earlier shows, there's a book called Being Still, Reflections on an Ancient Mystical Tradition, and the book on the cover, it is almost like it's almost the same thing. There's a roadway with these bare trees and mountains in the background.
Who's the artist?
The cover illustration is Saint Anthony the Abbot tempted by a heap of gold by the Osservanza master. It says Metropolitan Museum of Art.
So
I don't know.
That's so interesting.
I don't know when it was done, but it's sort of like this. Yeah, this guy, standing there. Anyway, it was kind of amazing. One of those neat connections.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because he's standing. Was the title says he's standing in front of gold or something? You said.
It says something. Yeah, something like that. Actually, it looks like a little animal, like a rabbit or a mole or something. But it's probably like this symbolic thing about the church and. Real material world
I use the gold. I remember his gold paint marker. I think on that piece with some charcoal.
Oh yeah.
And I really loved the contrast between the two. Yeah, I guess in response to your question, I still do little kind of art things. Conceptual pieces or some little. Art poems, I call them, when I'm sort of overwriting, it's like, hundreds, not thousands of words, so you can't even see the words anymore. Like, that kind of writing and that kind of artwork, I kind of still do it, but it's more of a meditative practice, and then I don't do it that often. I mean, I would say probably just 2013 I've played with that concept maybe once or twice in my journals, and... I haven't really been. I had a run where I was doing these little doodle drawings while I was at the high school teaching. So when I would go into the, we had a closet in which all the phone calls happened. Phone calls, business related phone calls.
In a closet.
Yeah, I was in a closet, and every time I went in that closet, there was this little pad. The dimensions were perfect. It was like maybe 3 inches by like. 4 inches, 3 by 4. Yeah, it's like a little index card, but it's a pad. And I started doing these drawings like several years ago while I was in there on the phone, just kind of mind, like no mind stuff. I'm obviously in the phone call, and the hand and the mind has some other subconscious thing going on the pad, So I would just do these drawings, and, some of the shapes are reminiscent of those trees that I drew for your cover. But they began taking this kind of whimsical, vibe or tone to them. And then they became kind of playful and then I started titling them, like weird boonerisms of like popular titles of songs or poems or adages or proverbs, just like spinning them a little bit, and I don't know, I had a whole bunch of those, and that's kind of the last big art project I did. I did maybe about a year or two worth of those drawings. I have, I don't know, maybe a few hundred of them in an envelope somewhere. I like to show them. I mean, I really think that the art, visual art, or I'm not going to call it fine art because I have no training in that kind of field, but visual, that kind of art is really close to me, obviously, because of my grandfather was a Cubist painter. So, I mean, I have, inclinations to go there. I just don't have any kind of real training in that regard. So I just sort of play, it's really kind of a stress-free kind of playing.
The thing about play, it reminded me, I recently heard a little interview with, or seen an old interview with Buffy St. Marie, the Native American singer, and she, I think she's in her 60s now, and she was talking about, she used the phrase something like a kindergarten artist or something like that. It was basically, she was saying, how little kids, you take a bunch of kids out to the beach, they will play in the sand. They will draw, they will do architecture, they will dance, they will sing, they're like natural, we're born natural artists, and something, gets in the way a lot of times for a lot of people, but I just like the way she said it's like that feeling of being a kindergartner while doing your art.
I love it.
That's a helpful thing.
I really love it.
And yeah, I want to get to your wonderful book of poems, In the Architecture of Bone, because that ties in a lot with your grandfather. First, going to throw in one more of the publications, the All Book Books, the Haiku One Breaths, where you got one. I got it, the page number, so I'll read it, and then
you
can comment on your haiku if you want. It's in quotes, and the first two lines are in quotes. Life is grand, even with a detour, say the trees. It's kind of human. Yeah. It's kind of whimsical. Life is grand, even with a detour, say the trees.
I think when I wrote that, I was living at Walt Whitman's place.
Oh, wow.
I think that one came out of some walks up to James Hill, which is the highest point on Long Island. But it's more universal, certainly, the messages, but I'm just sort of placing it. And, this idea, I mean, the trees are always there, right? And particularly, in the woods or the forest. But, like, you know, to me, they're kind of, yeah, they're inviting us, right, to go on these little detours. Like, it's all right, go this way, it's fine, you'll be all right.
Okay.
And that's kind of, was born out of a lot of walks around James Hill. I used to love walking around there.
Huh.
But really, the idea is take it, even though we don't think the detour oftentimes leads to bliss or enchantment or any kind of sort of magic, the trees know that it does. They're there all the time. In the detour. They are the detour. They're in the detour all the time. The detour to us, we're going to see that maple or that birch or something like that when we, step away from our crazy life and take a different way home or something like that. But that tree is there all the time,
Yeah, that's beautifully said.
Yeah.
Now getting on to your book, this was published by Gen Pop Books, the publishing name. GENPOP Books, and
9.
And it's called In the Architecture of Bone. It's a lot of, some of it's playful, like, word poems with you experiment with the words on the page and, different layout and some quirky stuff. But to me, the meat of it is like these deep poems. Well, part of it is that you're talking about your Armenian. You're all Armenian or part Armenian?
I'm 100% Armenian. I was born in America, but I'm 100% Armenian.
Yeah, I think it was through you that I really didn't know anything about the whole Turkish and the Armenian genocide and all that. And it was like, wow, meeting you and getting to talk a little bit, it was like, interesting to learn. But another area with a genocide thing going on. But the poems are, they're very intricate, uplifting. There's just a lot of depth to them. You touch on a lot of stuff. And I found what I took away most was sort of like, your grandfather as a muse. Because I was there, you have these conversations with him in the kitchen or his apartment. And it reminded me of, probably anybody who was just sat and talked with an older relative, and how precious those moments are. Maybe can you say a little bit about, that, or how the book, is that what triggered, wanting you to write the book about your grandfather, or was it the sort of whole, your whole upbringing?
I think it was a little bit of both. I mean, before the impetus to create a book was just kind of discovered through the process of getting my MFA at Goddard College. And I had all these poems that I was writing they were kind of two different poems, which kind of ended up being two different sections of the book. And the first one was just that, what you said, were these sort of family poems exploring family. I used to never write like that. I mean, I kind of always wrote about, anything sort of like, everything. I mean, we write about everything, but really often. But ultimately, the target things, the kind of like injustice and clouds and relationships and, flowers and metaphors and nature and all these, there was just whatever the topics were, they were. Kind of as I was growing up as a teenager and then sort of into my 20s. It became kind of almost like genre, I'm sorry, like a movement type of thing. So I kind of really get into the beats, and then I kind of really get into sort of language poets, and I kind of get into the New York school, and I would kind of like experiment and kind of, but I didn't really, carve out anything for myself until I started looking inward and looking at my family, and then, you know, and I kind of got the okay to do that through this guy named Peter Balakian, who is a terrific writer, scholar, and a mentor for me. You know, he teaches up in Colgate, wonderful man, and probably the one of the, you know, premier scholars on the Armenian genocide in the world, really. He's written a few books about it. Now, when I met him, he wasn't really writing about the genocide. He was writing, I mean, he was writing about Armenian issues and history and kind of what it's like to, you know, to live with this thing in your life, in your world, that is unreconciled and kind of unknown, as you said earlier, to the rest of the world. Like, it's, the Armenian genocide is not something, it's still, I mean, it's getting a lot more attention now, thankfully, coming upon the 100-year anniversary of it, in 2015. And, but it was not something that was taught in textbooks. It was something that was sort of, you know, really, really quickly skimmed over in class when I was growing up in high school. I don't even remember it coming up in social studies or history class. So it was just this weird part of myself and my history that wasn't really recognized or known by others. And you know, my grandfather was a survivor. So Peter kind of gave me the permission, if you will, to allow that bit of history and identity making and, you know, familial dynamics into my work. You know, he was kind of reading his work, Father Fisheye and some other poems, and sort of in my later 20s, mid to later 20s, studying with him over at the Shenango Valley Writers Conference and this and that. I kind of just, all of a sudden, things clicked. Like, oh, I can go inward. I don't have to keep going outward. I can go inward for my poetry. So I started exploring family dynamics, and then I came up with these kind of, that was like one set of, that was like part one of the book, which is all about family and my grandfather and what he kind of has lived through and his painting and how that is symbolic of some of the issues that he's had to deal with and what it means to be an artist. And then the second section really is more universal. You know, it's this idea of like what is genocide and injustice and, you know, how does it, what does it mean in relation to human behavior throughout history? And it's just a broader thing with a, paints on a big, you know, broader brush, I guess, the second part of the book.
Yeah, it is an interesting topic. It's hard to say a lot at this moment, but just thinking about, you know, the whatever, the World War II and the whole genocide there, and then, the you know, on this land, Native American, I think a lot of people don't realize, like, 90-95%. Of the Native Americans were wiped out, so it's like, it's like sometimes step back and go, what is going on with this in the world that there's like these, you know, genocides? So it's some kind of, that's a whole other topic, but
It's a big topic. I mean, it's just like scars of history, you know?
That's a neat phrase.
Deep scars in history, you know, the Native American indigenous cultures here in North America and South America, and really, I mean, and then, you know, you just see the same things repeated, Mark. That's the thing that's so crazy, is that, you know, we change so much, but you know, there are still these really, really subversive divisions that we have and how we relate to each other. And, I mean, I think that we still have a long way to go.
All right, Alan, there's a sort of, I don't know, maybe touching in a little bit on mysticism or of the culture, but you have a neat poem I'd like to hear you read, called How to Read a Fortune in a Cup of Turkish Coffee.
Sure, yeah. That's a fun one. I'll just preface it, I guess, by saying the Turkish coffee referred to is really a, it's just like, it's kind of an espresso. I mean, I suppose for most listeners, it's just sort of thick, you know, very heavy coffee that, you know, many cultures attribute to, you know, as to, or call Turkish coffee. You know, Armenians, you know, they call it Armenian coffee too, but there's a reason why I say what it is.
Okay.
As we read it, you'll know. I mean, I'll just Well, I'll just read it to you, and then we can talk about it after if you want.
Sure.
How to Read a Fortune in a Cup of Turkish Coffee. This is an epigraph here from Nazim Hikmet. He says, I haven't gone to places most people visit, mosques, churches, temples, synagogues, sorcerers, but I've had my coffee grounds read. She studied fate on Sundays. It wasn't every Sunday, but it felt like it, mostly because of the way she held the handle, read the insides like fantastic scriptures, subway maps. It was easy for her. In 10 minutes of work, she'd find two birds carrying white beaded necklaces, a baby in the trees, and the curse of an eye exploding out of a volcano. The young in the family couldn't wait to grow up, their tongues hanging out for coffee and the lick of the old country. In the Semerjian family room, the women sang stories like gypsies while I marked my height against the hall closet door. They read each other's minds. One blue afternoon, I saw my mother spin her own cup. I remember how she swirled its insides, loosening the essential fibers at the bottom, and then turned it over. The tiny layer of thick mud poured into the saucer's curves. Its descent was slow and complete, and the handle of the cup, upside down now, looked like an Armenian nose. She, too, gave her cup to my grandmother. She who washed her clothes, translated her mail, took the same address, and never made a sound to wake her at night across the hall. She asked for her fate as well. What could my grandmother tell her? What could she read in the bottom of that cup of coffee that she didn't help write? What could she unpack that wasn't already put away? They tried at it for hours, hours turned to days, days turned to weeks, and weeks turned the conversations into graffiti you almost forget is there. I knew then that I would ask for the same treatment. Over time, I would finish my cup in a dimly lit Middle Eastern cafe on the Lower East Side and tell the waiter to keep the change. My grandmother would be long passed away. My mother would not be around, perhaps in the old family home, worrying about the length of my coat for the season. I knew then that when the night came, I would put my pen and notebook away, turn the cup over, and imagine what he'd see.
Wonderful poem.
Yeah.
Wow, just, that's so so rich. I think I'm just going to let people hear it and let that settle, because we could talk,
yeah,
about,
thank you, thanks.
Could talk about that for an hour. I like the ending a lot, that to put the pen and notebook away and turn the cup over, and yeah, that's really neat.
I kept thinking they should have a pronoun at the end there or something. That, you know, I wasn't sure. I went back and forth on that. I was thinking about if I wanted my sort of mother to imagine it, or my grandmother to imagine, or the waiter to imagine. And ultimately, I think the waiter was the most important person for me in that moment.
Yeah, it puts it right in your experience at the time.
That's right.
Another one with your grandfather. It's a long poem, but just like to read section 3, the middle of the story.
Sure.
That'd be give people a flavor of what, you know, I was saying about you mentioned a lot of family members in the book, but the sort of stood out to me is that kind of kitchen table chat with the grandfather.
Yeah, this one is right in the middle of that long sequence of poems. It is called, indeed, The Middle of the Story. This one has an epigraph by Edward de Bono. A memory is anything that happens that does not completely unhappen. On the matted table in the family kitchen, you pause mid-sentence. Orphaned, a knot of words. Did I ever tell you? And before this, as a child, backdrop of classical music in your studio, meditations on childhood, the institution that took you in after your parents were taken. And then your leaving, open-mouthed, dilated stare. Your fingers, a baton, conducting Dvorak's concertos, a cello bow to the air. You drop your purple glossed olive, the climbing scallion smell, the tea you've been drinking for every day. Once you said, hungry is the best sauce. and I knew before Cairo, before this. Samsonian, the Armenian of Samsun, the artist, your family of brushes, painting in Alexandria, the faces of merchants who exchange paper for your work, one kind of transaction in the world. And the old Garrett you spoke about, how you met her there, your pupil, and cried during the ceremony and cursed during the silence under your breath what you did not have. There are several interrupted like you, surveys of people confused with altars. Surveys of people in search of a name, surveys like grandfather's closets, the shape of a temporary Russian hat, counting the remaining beats in a measure of a finger interrupting the history of air. You begin again in the middle of the story, orphaned, so I'll never know how far away it really was. Your stiffened wooden legs tilted toward balancing memory, the missing words spilling over, the empty pews behind you.
Another very, very wonderful. Thanks for reading those. Yeah,
thank you.
I had an asterisk around finger interrupting the history of air. That's a neat line. Think about that half the day. Like, what does he mean by that?
It was just something, you know. He spoke with his hands. My grandfather.
I was listening to some Bob Dylan songs, and sometimes I just laugh because it seems like, you know, you could say, what did he mean by that? Some lines seem like they were just a good rhyme, and, you know, it didn't mean it. It means whatever. He might have meant absolutely nothing by it. It just sounded good. I don't know. But
some of it is like that. Yeah, some of it is just sort of, you know, and then some of it is kind of, you know, subconsciously kind of created, too.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
There's somebody, the French, I forget which philosopher or critic or somebody said that, like, 10% of the French avant-garde, you know, art and film, and I think he was talking mostly about film, had to be intentionally, inaccessible. Like, it had to be kind of out there on its own, 10% of it, in order for it to be, you know, accepted by, you know, amongst its peers. The work would have to kind of have this similar aesthetic with 10% of it. And then he went on to say, of course, that, like, it's not necessarily that it doesn't mean anything. It just means that perhaps when it was in the creation process, it's like, yet there's stuff to be discovered about that line when you're writing it, you know. This was referring to film, but I would dare to say that the same is true for poetry.
Yeah, I think it works best when it's sort of a happy accident type of thing. But because when it's done deliberately, sometimes it's sort of, officious to be whatever. I've heard that sometimes in poetry, it's almost like deliberately trying to mess with somebody's mind a little bit.
Yeah.
It's all a matter of taste, I guess.
I suppose so, yeah.
All right. Well, yeah, we got in the remaining time. Wanted to highlight your new album. Also want to make sure to mention you have a bunch of websites, or how can people find, you know, get a hold of your book and your CDs, and is it all on your AlanSamerjian.com?
Well, AlanSamerjian.com has become sort of the primary place for music.
Okay.
There are an older site at this point, and it's sorely in need of revision.
Okay.
That kind of functions as a hub for other things, and that's Alan Arts, AlanArts.com.
Okay.
But that is, it really needs updating, and it really doesn't have much information on the new book at all. The best way to get the new book is from the publisher, really, is Gen Pop Books. I mean, I think the best way to do anything at this point, and I even sort of urge my students to do a sort of well-phrased Google search.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Google has become just, you know, everybody's kind of website in a weird way. It's kind of odd how that happened.
Yeah, that's interesting.
You know? But it really is a way to kind of access, if you do it right. I mean, a lot of people don't know how to use Google in terms of quotation marks and things like that, but if you do it well, you can get to anything you really want to get to.
Yeah, you can find tons of stuff. Actually, it's sort of like a little bit of a pet peeve that I try to say web search, because it's like the way Kleenex became... It's really a tissue, but people started calling it a brand name.
That's right. You can use Bing or anything.
I try to say web search. And.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're right. Search the web for it any way you'd like. I mean, the Google name, yeah, right. It's sort of like, what's that other one? Jell-O or Kleenex or whatever, all that kind of like corporate branding.
Yeah.
And it really is. You can get to it any way you want. I mean, I wonder if some of the other, aggregators of you know, stuff on the internet and the web, I wonder if they are, I wonder how they're organizing their data, you know?
Yeah.
I know this one, Google that I mentioned does it in a fairly intuitive way, but I have a feeling, that it probably has its foibles and issues because of its size.
Oh, yeah. Some of it is rigged in the sense of, what sells, I think, and sometimes
right.
I've typed in stuff like, I'm trying to remember, but it could be something like, say like pine trees, and say there was a famous movie, called Pine Trees.
Sure.
I think it was one of those. It's like that famous TV show about the vampire relationships or whatever that Twilight or something.
Twilight. Right,
yeah, yeah.
Right.
I think I was searching up I was looking for a photo to go with a haiku of Twilight. So
right.
I type in Twilight and the first 50 things. Were about the show Twilight, and it bothered me because it was like, wait a second, this is a word called Twilight, and all I'm first thing
right.
up is this TV show. It's like, so
right,
that pushed my button.
As it should. I mean, some of it is, I'd have to look more into this, but I wonder if that's the case because of some sort of, money situation, capitalistic relationship. I wonder if it's free. I wonder if it's truly aggregating its searches on just from interest, or if there's some other thing involved. Yeah, I know they have an ad section.
Yeah, yeah.
As well.
Yeah.
Great on or something like that. Anyway, that's a whole different.
Yeah, before I just want to mention before we get too sidetracked, there's a wonderful online writer. I think he's got some nonfiction books called Pepe Escobar. He writes about world affairs, and he used a phrase recently called the Google generation. I think he was talking about Egypt, and he was talking about, the Google generation protesting, and it's a neat phrase. Hey, I've been running that phrase through, through the mind, and, I wonder if it's going to stick kind of thing. So it's an interesting phrase, because, there is that thing now where people look up, there's a certain generation that is growing up or are already looked everything they want to know, they just look up.
Yep.
It's like, how does this person know how to cook, whatever, souffle, this and that? Oh,
looked it up on
Google. your album is, what is the title of, the title of your album is excellent, Quiet Songs for Loud Times.
Mm-hmm.
It reminded me of the Hearts of Space is an ambient online, and it's on once a week on some radio stations around the country, and their motto for 25, 35 something years is slow music for fast times. So,
yeah, you mentioned that before. Yeah, that's very reminiscent, right?
Yeah. So how did you get to that? This is your fourth CD?
This is my third, my third kind of CD on the books. Okay. And what I mean by that is that, where they have digital distribution. Where it's, kind of out in the world, and you can get it anywhere. You can stream it on Spotify, you can get it on, whatever iTunes you use, or any kind of, even a lot of, hopefully it's there, smaller music, retail outlets, and you can even get, hard copies if you want from independent retailers like CD Baby and some other places.
Excellent.
Which is really great. So it's my third, but I've made a whole bunch of other records before. I just don't have them, quote-unquote, sort of on the books. They're just, they exist independently. I made 100 copies of this record called Hero City, which was a while back, and I really love that record. I just didn't print up too many copies of that album, that CD, and a bunch of others of my old band Surreal and Milktoast, and a bunch of other bands I was in as well, Stratosphere, Watercats, things like that.
Wow, yeah, that's a lot. Yeah, I'm gonna use you as an example of a thing that I like to say. Poets make better lyrics. When writing songwriting, because I can tell the poetry. I'm just gonna give you share with people some lines that stood out. when I listen to it. I think there's one song called "You Can't Teach Trouble to Sing," which is you know, neat in it. That's a neat line. And then there's a line in there, something about "Pound your head against invisible wall." And there's another one, "Make the best of what your evening brings." And then there's a great line. There's a song called "Breakdown." You have "You can't grow up until you can't break down." That's some deep psychology there. Like,
you can't grow up until
you can't break down. And then there's another song called "Your Enemy." There's a line, "I am the sea. You can throw pebbles into me." There's another song, "Lullaby," that something about beauty across the sky. It reminded me of the Navajo have a blessing way. There's a kind of most well-known prayer, so like beauty before me, beauty behind me, you know, beauty above me, beauty inside me, beauty as I walk. So that song reminded me of that. So those are
that's a big one too. That one in particular, you know, the Navajo prayer. You're thinking about, I'm pretty sure we're talking about the same one, but I'm pretty sure that one was, part of my reference when I was constructing the lyrics for that song. I was thinking about a prayer, or really a blessing or a prayer for you know, a child coming into the world. Like, what would I want to tell this child?
Oh,
you know?
That's beautiful.
And that's really what the song is, Lullaby. It's the last song on the record,
Yeah, what was it like, the process? Because this was different from some of your other albums. It's just sort of more, I don't know, more sort of poetic, thoughtful, sort of, you know, kind of lines to help people deal with stuff, kind of songs in a way. It's not the greatest categorizing, but that's just some of what I took away from it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there, you know, I've found over the course, or during the course of writing this, writing these songs for the CD, you know, last 3 years or so, I just noticed a whole bunch of, you know, external vibrations, you know, and the Occupy movement, just what's happening, you know, Arab Awakening and different kinds, you know, Spring, Arab Spring, and these sort of like, I guess, just external movements of, you know, shifts, major sort of shifts going on, you know, whether they be good or bad or you know, contentious or not. You know, I just felt it in there, and I felt that a lot of those external vibrations mirrored what's going on for many of us internally. You know, whether it be and vice versa. You know, so sometimes the internal vibrations can create, can manifest external vibrations, and so on and so forth, back and forth. I think it's just all connected.
Right.
So, you know, like, when I mean internal is like, you know, shifts, deep personal transformations, realizations, you know, reconciliations with others and ourselves, you know, growing older, maturity, coming to grips with mortality. Like, you know, maybe it has something to do with, you know, kind of moving into the next decade of time in my life. You know, I was in my 30s when I started writing this record. And then, and now literally I just hit 40.
All right.
So it's, so it's sort of like moving out from one segment of life to another. And the, you know, always with my music, there is a deep, exploration of interpersonal relationships, like how, you know, two people, there's always like this sort of other, those are you in all of my songs. In my poems too, but I really explore that dynamic in my music probably more than anything else. There's always, you know, I'm really, really fascinated with proximity and longing and distance away from other people and how we kind of build walls around ourselves and that kind of stuff. It's like, I'm really, really, really preoccupied with that in my songwriting. So, this time around, I just tried to make music that kind of honors that, as opposed to, you know, experiment with, like, my last couple of records, like my last one experimented with a kind of an American sound, big Americana rock record, and the one before that was very, very eclectic and experimental in nature. And this one is really, like, it's just a quieter, you know, introspective kind of record where it's just like looking inward and trying to make sense of all these things that are happening outside of us as well as the loud times that are resonating inside of us. So,
yeah, that's very interesting, the whole the process you described, because I didn't get a lot of the sort of political or world events thing going on in when I first heard the album, but it sounds like, you know, you can get that influence, but it doesn't always have to be.
That's right.
It can, what's going on in the world can stir you, but you can translate it into something else, or what's going on inside, you can just an interesting process there.
Yeah, I mean, for me, like, for instance, the one, the song Old Musician Store, which is towards the end of the CD.
Yeah, like,
that one is
very touching.
Yeah, I mean, that's just a real song about, this really great guys on Long Island that make they were a music repair store that had some retail stuff going on too. They were in Melville, New York, where I kind of grew up after I left Queens with my family, and near where I live. So, I mean, just it's about these guys that had this store in Melville who basically had to move out because they just couldn't afford the rent anymore. And they're just a great group of two guys. It's called New York Music and Repair. Anyway, they're still in business. They just sort of changed their model of working because they couldn't afford, what they were doing. And I think that is a direct result of economic changes and hard times and, maybe a model that is, problematic and needs some changing, this economic kind of model that's squeezing out the little guy,
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was interesting to hear the song because it was like one of those songs that is sort of more current about something that, I remember noticing with bookstores and the music stores. So it was sort of like the first song I had heard about, recent history in a way. So I found it interesting that way in a kind of time frame way.
Exactly. You got it. It's the same thing with bookstores and same thing with anything of that nature.
Yeah, I remember writing up. It was right after the 2008 the economic downturn, and there was a bunch of I was out at one of the little strip malls, and all the empty stores. I wrote some poem about. It reminded me of missing teeth kind of thing. So I just took that metaphor and turned it into a comment on what's going on. So it's again the arts. It's great. I really enjoyed talking with you because it reminded me of a lot and things you said very deeply, the thing about looking inward as an artist and, again, how you're influenced by the world. And, in this case with the Musician Store song, just noticing what's right around you. And it's just, again, there's so many ways to go about producing something that's called, quote, art.
Yeah, you're right, man. Yeah, I think you're right.
Thanks
for giving me the time, Monk. I appreciate it, and I'll always enjoy our conversations. They always take us to new places, and I hope whoever's listening enjoyed it as well. I appreciate the time.
You bet, and I'll put the your website links up on I put the information on the webpage along with the audio show, and I guess we'll go out with the lullaby song. That sounds nice.
Perfect. Thanks, man.
All right. Thanks a lot, Alan. Keep up the good work.
Thanks, brother. I'll speak to you soon.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Stay.